Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 501, titled Norbert Schley and the Strange Case of the 57s. This is being recorded on March 6th of the year 2005. We're going to continue with our account of the legal crucifixion, so to speak, of the late Norbert Schley, an assistant attorney general who had a lot to do with the enactment of civil rights legislation in the United States. After he went into private practice, he attempted to get some 57 bonds redeemed on the behalf of some of his Asian clients. These were very strange bonds indeed. They were derived from the M Fund, which in turn was illegally confiscated Japanese war loot, which was retained by the Japanese and Americans in order to basically swing Japanese politics to the right at the end of, or in the post-war period. When the 57s were issued, the idea was to have them redeemable only by certain inside players, and if you weren't an inside player, you were basically told to take a hike, and if you wouldn't do that, you were crucified, and that's what happened to Norbert Schley. We're going to continue now with our account of what happened to Norbert Schley when he attempted to legally redeem what were legal documents on behalf of his Japanese clients. Speaking of the jury in the Schley case, the jury was not told that acting CIA Director Admiral William O. Studemon had informed the New York Times in March of 1995 that CIA was not about to divulge information on the subject of payola to foreign governments and politicians. Studemon said the agency had an obligation to keep faith, unquote, with politicians who received legally authorized covert support from the United States, unquote. This statement actually confirms that such payments were made and merely refuses to give details. Japanese politicians bribed with huge sums of money had to be protected, which was more important than justice in American courts. Schley told the court, quote, I figured that if the Iran-Contra case people like Ollie North and Admiral Poindexter and Mr. McFarland could be doing things and lying about it, then maybe people in the Japanese government could be lying about some things, too, unquote. Judge Kovacevic refused Schley the right to take depositions in Japan and brushed aside Schley's protest that a key defense witness had been intimidated by the U.S. attorney. His attorneys alleged that the prosecution tampered with the witness, S.M. Hahn, who had an immunity agreement with U.S. attorney Mark Crum. Hahn swore that Crum told him if he testified for the defense, his immunity agreement would be nullified. Hahn also said Crum told him that he had better not give him any basis to withdraw the immunity because he would not hesitate to do so, unquote. Witness tampering is one of the most serious crimes in the U.S. judicial system and is grounds for disbarment. Judge Kovacevic denied a motion for a new trial based on the charge of witness tampering and even refused to hold an evidentiary hearing to determine whether Hahn's allegations were true. After 6 years of prosecution, Schley was convicted on one felony count of securities fraud and one misdemeanor. Before the trial began, he had assets in the neighborhood of $10 million. During his trial, he was unable to practice law and had enormous legal costs. He was professionally and financially ruined, left virtually bankrupt. He estimated that the U.S. government spent over $45 million of taxpayers' money on the sting and the lawsuit. Schley appealed, and in September 1997, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals reversed and vacated the conviction on the felony count and the misdemeanor, remanding the misdemeanor to the district court for a hearing on Schley's motion for a new trial based on government intimidation of witnesses. The three appeals court judges paid special attention to the way Kovacevic had handled the witness tampering issue. In their decision, they wrote that the transactions leading to the Schley indictment were unusual, if not bizarre, unquote. They found Kovacevic's handling of the witness tampering enigmatic. They said, we cannot determine whether Schley was deprived of his right to due process because the Kovacevic court did not conduct an evidentiary hearing where defendants present evidence to the district court that the government intimidated a defense witness. A trial court must grant a hearing to determine whether the allegations of intimidation are true. So a case that was contrived to start with and dragged on for 6 years, resulting in Schley's complete ruin, was overturned. Still insisting on his innocence, Schley asked for a retrial, but the government knew he was broke. Nearly 70 and in no position to fight indefinitely to clear his name, he finally agreed not to press his charges of witness tampering, leaving the minor misdemeanor charge unresolved. In Washington to this day, he is slandered. An eminent libel lawyer who should know better recently insisted that Schley's evidence was untrustworthy, unquote, because he was a convicted felon, unquote. Others declared Schley's unresolved misdemeanor conviction amounted to, quote, moral turpitude, unquote. It took further wrangling with the California bar to have this smear removed from the official record. In January of 2001, the California bar announced that Schley was once again an attorney in good standing, unquote. But the harm had been done. In the spring of 2002, while jogging on a California beach, Schley suffered a major heart attack, collapsed, and hit his head. A homeless man nearby called for help, but Schley remained in a coma for many months. The last time we saw Schley, he told us, quote, "I now know how and why the jury convicted me. Until I figured that out, I was a very troubled man," unquote. Other events unfolding in January of 1992 may have led directly to Schley's persecution. He was not the only target of M. Fund stings. Also arrested was James P. Sena, a 17-year veteran of the U.S. Secret Service, the agency that also investigates counterfeiting for the Treasury Department. Sena had examined M. Fund financial instruments in America and Japan, where he became convinced of the legitimacy of the 57s. He decided to sell some himself. He and Ian Yorkshire of Great Britain and Francis Chung of Hong Kong were all arrested for attempting to market 57s with a total face value of $50 billion. Abruptly, and for no reason, in November 1995, the case against them was suddenly dismissed with prejudice, unquote, meaning the charges cannot be refiled. Nevertheless, prosecutors refused to return the 57s they had confiscated as evidence, calling them contraband, unquote. If counterfeit, why were they contraband? We were told by a Wall Street source that Treasury is eager to get its hands on 57s and other supposedly counterfeit derivatives to negotiate them secretly. Now we're going to contrast the treatment of Gene Bravender Alou with Norbert Schley with the treatment afforded Alexander Haig, a Republican bigwig and also someone who married into the family of prominent MacArthur staffer. And we're going to see how Alexander Haig was able to redeem some 57s on behalf of the Paraguayan government with the assistance of then-President George H.W. Bush, former director, of course, of the CIA and father of the current seated president. Another prominent American who reportedly became involved in negotiating 57s during the same period was the former Secretary of State General Alexander Haig. Unlike Schley, Haig was not arrested or persecuted, demonstrating how selective Washington had been in choosing its sting targets. According to a detailed account we have from someone present at all the meetings, Haig was asked to intercede in behalf of Paraguay. The government of Paraguay had bought a single 57 with a face value of $500 million from First Hanover Securities in New York City on November 20, 1991, at the very moment the sting of Mrs. Alou was going down. The same day, Paraguay asked MIC Debt Readjustment Company to arrange for the Japanese government to redeem this 57, not for cash, but for credit against 40 billion yen in foreign aid that Paraguay owed to Tokyo. This represented 80% of the face value of the 57, and Tokyo could keep the other 20% as a discount. MIC is an organization backed by the Israeli government, which negotiates adjustments of national debt for governments in Eastern Europe and South America. If successful, MIC was to be given oil exploration and development rights on Paraguayan territory. After considering former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger and former Ambassador Mike Mansfield, MIC chose Haig as their negotiator. He was a good choice. Haig knew Japan because in 1947, fresh out of West Point, he had served as an aide to General MacArthur in Tokyo until the general's recall in 1951. As a MacArthur aide working in a tight circle with men like Whitney and Willoughby, Haig doubtless heard a lot about black operations and secret funds set up in Tokyo during the occupation. While in Japan, Haig married the daughter of General Alonzo Patrick Fox, MacArthur's deputy chief of staff. Haig later served President Nixon on the National Security Staff, was White House chief of staff for both Nixon and Ford, and Secretary of State for President Reagan. At a strategy meeting in Miami attended by our source, MIC and the Paraguayans asked Haig to negotiate personally with former Japanese Prime Minister Takashita, a key man in the M Fund and one of the LDP kingmakers. After being embarrassed by bribery scandals, including the recruit scandal involving M Fund kickbacks and war loot, Takashita had been forced to resign as Prime Minister 2 years earlier in 1989, but he remained powerful. Haig agreed to meet with Takashita in Tokyo in January of 1992. He reportedly told the Miami Roundtable that the 57 should be negotiated underground, unquote, as quickly as possible. To learn more about the background of the 57s, our source said Haig had discussions in Washington with the FBI and CIA, much as Schley had done. One CIA official explained that Japan had a number of secret funds, including what he called the MacArthur Fund, apparently referring to the Sanwa Bank joint account in the names of MacArthur and Hirohito, which Japanese call the Showa Fund, referring to the reign title of Hirohito. He also explained how the Japanese government bonds had evolved into the 57s. Our source said Haig also paid a visit to the White House to tell President Bush of his forthcoming meeting with Takashita to negotiate the 57 for Paraguay. Explaining the give and take involved, he asked Bush for his support. To ease the way, our source said, Bush gave Haig a personal letter to Takashita. President Bush was on his way to Japan himself that January. He was in Tokyo a few days before Haig, a visit made famous when Bush vomited all over Prime Minister Miyazawa. On January 13, 1992, Haig was informed that 2 weeks later he was to be guest of honor at a lunch in Tokyo's Imperial Hotel with the LDP Diet Committee, after which he and Takashita were to have a private talk in an adjoining room. MIC said Takashita would probably start by saying all 57s were counterfeit. Haig had to be prepared for this and ready to say two or three things that would jolt Takashita. He asked MIC to choose the three most impressive supporting documents to show Takashita. One of these was an insurance policy issued by Yasuda Fire Insurance Company in Tokyo to cover transporting the certificate from the Ministry of Finance. This alone established the authenticity of the 57. MIC briefed Haig in detail about the significance of these supporting documents and reviewed the differences between 57s and ordinary Japanese government bonds. Shortly before the meeting in Tokyo on the 27th, Haig was told that Takashita had been acutely embarrassed by a recent series of major scandals, so what the LDP leader hoped to get from Haig was a promise to stop Japan bashing in America. If Takashita could come out of their meeting with such an assurance, he might survive the scandals and resume power. When the two men sat down privately at 2:40 p.m., our source said Takashita opened as predicted, asking Haig to get U.S. companies and politicians to stop Japan bashing. Haig replied positively, handing Takashita the personal letter from President Bush. Takashita then said that any agreement on settling Paraguay's debt to Japan would have to include Japanese participation in developing oil fields in that country. With that on the table, Haig explained that one of the main reasons for his visit to Tokyo was to get Takashita's assurance that Paraguay's 57 would be credited against its foreign aid debt. He showed Takashita the 57 that Paraguay had purchased from Hanover. Takashita glanced at the document and said, "Mr. Haig, this paper is a forgery printed in Hong Kong," unquote. Then Haig said, please take a look at these documents, unquote. He handed Takashita the Yasuda insurance cover document and the two others. Reading each document in turn, Takashita's face turned pale and his voice faint. Mr. Haig, he said, it seems to include a very delicate problem for the settlement. Yes, said Haig, I agree. It's delicate. I cannot give you an immediate reply, unquote. The meeting ended, and minutes later, Haig reported all this to the MIC group in his suite. He said it was only when he saw Takashita recoil in shock at sight of the insurance cover that he realized how serious was the secrecy surrounding the 57s. Our source said Haig turned angrily to the Paraguayans and said, you're making me blackmail him. Then he grinned and said, that first missile hit the target, unquote. He warned the Paraguayans and Israelis to be very careful about their personal safety while they were in Japan, because Takashita was not happy, and he would certainly alert Japan's Secret Service. Next day, our source said Takashita's personal secretary came to see Haig. Insisting on talking in the hallway where they could not be monitored, he said, Mr. Haig, the certificate and documents are not formal, so our government cannot repurchase it, unquote. Haig squinted at him and said, so we can make it public, unquote. Takashita's secretary turned pale. He said he would again speak to Takashita. The second missile also hit home. The following morning, Takashita's secretary came again. As for the problem of the certificate, many inquiries are coming to our Ministry of Finance locally and overseas, and the administration is greatly perplexed. He paused. We are ready to take certain measures on the certificate in question. You must treat this negotiation as strictly confidential. If a similar demand is made by another government, our administration would suffer because we are not prepared for it financially, unquote. In short, Haig had succeeded and the deal went down. But how could Haig negotiate a 57 in Miami, Washington, and Tokyo with discussions at the FBI, CIA, and with President Bush in the White House without being arrested and prosecuted like Norbert Schley? Federal agents always insisted it was illegal to negotiate one inside America, or even to contemplate it. If all 57s are counterfeit, why did Haig succeed? If Haig's 57 was genuine, did he still do something illegal? Does the legitimacy of a Japanese debt instrument depend on your connections to the current occupant of the White House? Norbert Schley was drawn into the sting soon after Haig's Tokyo negotiation concluded. One of Takashita's conditions about ending Japan bashing may have been that Schley, who was asking so many embarrassing questions, must be silenced and removed from the field of play. If so, Haig certainly would have reported this to President Bush, which could explain why Schley was then dragged into the Ah Lu case. And again, this certainly suggests here that there was a quid pro quo, that basically, in exchange for an ending of Japan bashing and in exchange for the successful redemption of the Paraguayan 57, Schley was to be basically targeted and persecuted slash prosecuted. The Seagraves then go on to opine here. There is a lesson here for investors. Financial instruments growing out of the Black Eagle Trust continue to float around the global market like magnetic mines left over from World War II that can blow up and sink any institution or individual that comes in contact with them. If some certificates are counterfeit while others are legitimate, investors and their attorneys have a right to inquire without fear of arrest or intimidation whether the documents they hold are real or fake, and not to be brushed off with falsehoods, especially when the issuing government has a history of evasiveness and is strongly suspected of lying. When Washington demonstrates that it has a greater sense of responsibility to corrupt foreign politicians than it does to its own citizens, we may rightly ask whom it is really protecting. Washington's main concern has been to protect and preserve a system of secret financial collusion with Japan, which has worked to its satisfaction for over half a century. and to protect the careers and reputations of U.S. government officials involved in that collusion. In the end, how many billions went to Japanese politicians is less important than how much went into the pockets of American officials. As power corrupts, secret power corrupts secretly. Indeed. So again, note, first of all, that that the 57s were specifically done to protect the M Fund against overexposure when Mrs. Jean Bravender Alou tried to illegally redeem a 57. She was prosecuted and persecuted, basically a gravely ill and impoverished widow living on Social Security. She was destroyed. They then turned their attention to Norbert Schley, destroyed him. They've destroyed others, yet when Alexander Haig decided to redeem a 57, he was able to do so with the assistance of, among others, President George H.W. Bush. We're going to review now, ever so briefly, a little bit about the genesis of the M Fund. Turning once again to Gold Warriors by Peggy and Sterling Seagrave, three underground funds were controlled by American officials during the occupation: the M Fund, the Yotsuya Fund, and the Keenan Fund. According to Takano Hajime, the M Fund was named after General William Frederick Marquardt, chief of SCAP's Economic and Scientific Section. In theory, Marquardt headed America's program to punish and reform Japanese businesses that had gorged on war profiteering. In reality, Marquardt's biggest public relations headache was how to help them conceal these obscene profits, which by custom were shared with the imperial family. Historian John Dower explains that Marquardt, quote, assumed responsibility for nothing less than supervising all developments in finance, economics, labor, and science, including the dissolution of Zaibatsu holding companies and the promotion of economic deconcentration. Every major government financial and economic institution reported to his section, including the Ministry of Finance, the Ministry of Commerce and Industry, and the Bank of Japan. Skipping down, Marquardt was supposed to dissolve the banks and conglomerates that financed Japan's war and profited from it. Despite purely cosmetic changes and the breakup and sale of several small conglomerates, the biggest war profiteers were let off without even a slap on the wrist. Skipping down again, so while he was supposed to be making Japan more democratic, Marquardt was doing the opposite. The M Fund was created to buy elections for Japanese politicians so far to the right that they were solidly anti-communist. Japan was the most highly industrialized country in Asia. Washington wanted it to be a capitalist bastion against communism for its economy to thrive so there would be no need for labor unions, leftist organizers, or revolution. This was the view of American conservatives who thought President Roosevelt was a communist and believed that Britain should have allied itself with Germany and Japan and gone to war against the USSR. As a consequence of this thinking, plans to reform Japan were truncated or aborted. So that's the fund that was being protected, and again, it was composed of Japanese war loot. I will note on the back cover of the remarkable book Gold Warriors, one of the most important books ever written, in my opinion, there is a quote here. The Seagraves have uncovered one of the biggest secrets of the 20th century. That quote is from the late Iris Chang, the author of the landmark book about the Rape of Nanking called The Rape of Nanking. Iris Chang had been working on, among other things, the stories of American POWs who had been on the Bataan Death March and who had been held as slave laborers by many of these same Japanese Zaibatsu, the Japanese giant corporations that had been the beneficiaries of the machinations by Mr. Marquardt and the other architects of the M Fund. Iris Chang turned up an alleged suicide in November of the year 2004. Specifically, her corpse was discovered on Veterans Day, And I would note that, first of all, she, even though she'd had some serious problems battling depression, she had noted to a college classmate of hers who became a good friend that, quote, her problems were external, unquote. In other words, people who knew her thought her problems were all in her head, but she said her problems were, quote, external. Her alleged suicide, her death by gunshot, occurred as Governor Schwarzenegger was in Japan on a trip in order to promote Japanese commerce and tourism to California. One wonders whether perhaps Iris Chang was sacrificed, basically suicided, much like some other people in Japan who had run afoul of the M Fund, and whether perhaps her demise was deemed to be necessary in order to promote commerce and tourism between Japan and California and the United States. Again, the story of American POWs who were used as slave laborers and never compensated by the very Japanese corporations that were the vehicles protected by the M Fund, that is a story that is ongoing and obscene. And I would note the death of the late Iris Chang. Certainly tragic and quite possibly conspiratorial, in my opinion. We have dealt with Gold Warriors in many programs. As is the case with all of the For the Record programs, they are available for free online. Sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent shows are streaming on Real Audio, and some of them now on MP3. That is at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word, DaveEmory. And older shows are available for download only, also on Real Audio, on a longer URL, linked to both that address and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. Spitfire List is SpitfireList.com. The Spitfire CD duplication service stocks all of the programs I've done over the years. The last several For the Record shows are available for download, both on Real Audio and MP3. And the For the Record section of the Spitfire website features long, annotated, article-length descriptions of the For the Record shows, usually up within a week or two of the airing of the program. Please note that the Spitfire website features, probably at this point, several thousand pages of documentation. It also features the landmark text, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, by the late heroic Paul Manning, a book which basically deals with the same sort of machinations vis-a-vis the U.S. and Germany as Gold Warriors does between the U.S. and Japan. The book was suppressed. The author's career was destroyed. Paul Manning's career was destroyed. But that book is now available for free on both Adobe PDF and on HTML. In addition, the Spitfire website features a link to a website maintained by some heroic listeners in the Midwest, which features declassified U.S. government documents that conclusively document the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry before, during, and after World War II. There's also a page on the Spitfire website for listeners to click on to support the work that I'm doing. And if the things that you're hearing about here make you mad, if they trouble you, there's no better way of doing the fighting back than supporting yours truly. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 501, titled Norbert Schley and the Strange Case of the 57s. This is being recorded on March 6th of 2005. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.